WMAL News at 7. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. Truckers calling themselves the People's Convoy are leaving the West Coast next Tuesday en route to D.C. as they prepare to protest COVID mandates they feel are unconstitutional. Local and federal police in the district are preparing too.
We're going to plan as best we can, work with our partners, both local and federal, to do whatever we can to mitigate it. But right now, as we're working through, just kind of planning out what that will exactly look like, we'll be informing the public as we get closer to that time with recommendations.
Police Chief Robert Conti says the convoy will cause traffic jams. The truckers are telling Canadian truckers protesting in Ottawa who blocked a bridge causing trade issues that they're joining their call to freedom. Canadian police arrested more than 100 protesters in Ottawa yesterday and towed dozens of vehicles blocking streets near Canada's parliament.
Police in riot gear and automatic weapons started pushing through the protesters on Friday to try and clear the area. Police there are tweeting, quote, "You must leave. You must cease further unlawful activity and immediately remove your vehicle and or property from all unlawful sites. Anyone within unlawful protest sites will be arrested." Some of those protesters said they have no intention of leaving.
This could all be avoided if they just lift the mandates. It's that simple.
Police in Ottawa said there's been no serious injuries or fatalities in police actions.
Fox's Ashley Stromier. Three men plead guilty to voluntary manslaughter for killing 11-year-old Davon McNeil while a 4th of July barbecue was happening in 2020. McNeil was hit in the head by a stray bullet as he was walking from a car to an apartment. Daryl Bond, Marcel Gordon, and Christian Wingfield face between 7.5 and 10 years in prison if the court accepts their pleas. A fourth man pleaded not guilty to a first-degree murder charge and will go on trial. Starting next week, Prince William County public school students will no longer have to wear masks, but staff will.
Superintendent LaTanya McDade says employees are subject to the Virginia Infectious Disease Standard under the Virginia Department of Labor, which requires employers by law to have all employees, both vaccinated and unvaccinated, wear masks in times of high and substantial community transmission. McDade added, as it is now the option of parents and guardians to decide if their students will wear a mask, PWCS will respect each individual family choice and will not track parent choices. Rachel Sutherland on WMAL and WMAL.com.
Montgomery County is hosting another Boosterama today to encourage eligible residents to get the third COVID vaccine.
They will be at the Westfield Wheaton Mall between 1 and 4 p.m.
Sean O'Donnell, head of Montgomery County Emergency Management.
In addition to giving boosters, they will be able to give first or second doses if that's something you need with the vaccine they have on hand.
O'Donnell adding,
they'll have some rapid test kits and some N95 masks to give away to folks who've come to get vaccinated.
Vaccination rates across Montgomery County have reached nearly 85%. Barbara Britt, WMAL and WMAL.com.
Traffic and weather next on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Traffic and weather on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
On the Beltway in Virginia, Interloop McLean, there is a crash. Left lane is blocked near the George Washington Parkway, exit 43. 66 in Virginia is clear east and west. No delays on 95 in Virginia, northbound or southbound between the Beltway and Fredericksburg. Maryland side of the Beltway is clear in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County. And in Montgomery County on 270 between the Beltway and Frederick, no delays are being reported northbound or southbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Today, a cold front moves through. A wind advisory is in effect from noon to 7. Gusts as high as 49 miles an hour, a high of 51 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear, a low around 19. Right now, 39 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Now, on News Talk 105.9 WMAL,
the Saturday morning update.
It is hour two of the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. John Gizzi is the White House correspondent and chief political columnist at Newsmax and Newsmax TV. John, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
It's been another week of tension between Russia and the United States over Ukraine. Where are we at week's end in terms of how the president is viewing this and what we expect next?
As far as the United States is concerned, Biden and Vladimir Putin are eyeball to eyeball, to use a phrase from the Cuban Missile Crisis, and neither has shown any signs of blinking. But that's not the question. The question is, who's in the driver's seat in dealing with Mr. Putin? And based on his comments and speeches, as well as to those who cover him, it would seem that the president is in the passenger seat. Simply put, he has said repeatedly for a week that Russia is on the verge of an attack on Ukraine. And while it is true that there's more than 100,000 Russian troops poised outside the Ukraine border, no attack has yet to occur. There's even dispute about the number of troops. Russia has said it's withdrawn some of its troops after tactical operations and maneuvers were completed. The exercise is done. The troops went home. The State Department spokesman, Ned Price, on the other hand, said that the number of troops has increased. Meanwhile, it would seem when it comes to dealing with the man in the Kremlin, it's other younger world leaders in Europe who are taking the lead. France's President Emmanuel Macron has practiced his own shuttle diplomacy, first meeting over a long table with Vladimir Putin in Moscow, and then going to Kiev to meet with Ukraine's President Zelensky. In addition, German Chancellor Scholz has had talks with Russia and with Putin himself. And I spoke to three members of the German Bundestag, or Parliament, who said that there is no sentiment for conflict with Russia in Germany, that, in fact, most Germans would be perfectly happy to continue to get oil and natural gas supplied through the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, that Joe Biden urges them to shut off contacts and dealings with Russia. Put another way, as one put it, when it's 60 euros per barrel of oil, it's not a bad deal coming from Russia, particularly as it continues to grow cold in Europe. Finally, the talk about extreme sanctions against Putin, Foreign Minister Lavrov, and others in the Kremlin inner circle is not even viewed with unanimity by the NATO allies. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi said that sanctions such as that could cause harm to the European countries, that retribution from Russia could be harsh, and that this should be fought over further, given the interconnection between Europe and Russia. Overall, it's not as simple as it seems in Ukraine, and those who are involved directly in it seem to agree.
So the president spoke late Friday afternoon at the White House. He said he was, quote, convinced that Vladimir Putin had made the decision to invade Ukraine. When you say that, and you're dealing with somebody like Vladimir Putin, are you putting yourself in the position of potentially being embarrassed?
Well, I think he's already had a few dress rehearsals in that regard earlier in the week. This is, by my count, the third time the president has said a Russian strike at Ukraine is coming. It did not happen on Wednesday. It did not happen Thursday. I doubt it's going to happen today or on Sunday, just given the pattern that's out there. The problem with this president is he's going to warn the American people and put them on guard just once too often, so that if an attack does come, we might not really believe it.
Vice President Harris has come to the rescue. She's in Munich, I guess, to work on the border. But if it's anything like the other border that she supposedly was working on, not looking for too much out of that.
I attended the Munich Security Conference back in 1995, and it's an important meeting to go to. The defense ministers and military leaders of the NATO allies are there. So when the vice president attends this, it almost puts the official imprimatur on the alliance with our NATO partners. And indeed, she deals with the top defense and national security officials. Past Vice Presidents Biden and Pence have been regulars at the Munich conference. The question is just precisely what will Kamala Harris have to tell these people? Many of them are not on the same page as President Biden, notably our German allies and the French, who are already pursuing their negotiations. Does she say, for example, that President Biden encourages them when his rhetoric is far more alarmist? In addition, President Zelensky and his people will be there in Munich, and for his part, the Ukraine president has urged calm because he sees no disorder in his country at this point. It'll be interesting to see what Vice President Harris says when she returns on Monday.
Well, somebody who won't be returning in 2023 is New York Representative Kathleen Rice. What's the count now, John?
Well, it's 30 Democrats who are saying out of here, either running for another office or simply retiring. Ms. Rice, who represents the Nassau County 4th District in the Empire State, is stepping down after 8 years in Congress. Now, she won with relative ease over the last 8 years and was not affected in a critical way by the recent redistricting in New York. After all, Democrats are wielding the knife. So why is she stepping down? It has to be the proverbial personal reasons or a feeling that Democrats will be in the minority come the next Congress, and that's not going to be much fun after she's been in the majority. In any event, Democrats are now 10 seats away from the modern high of retirees. And that was in 1992 when 40 House Democrats stepped down. The next step will be when Pennsylvania's redistricting plan comes down, and already the predictions are growing. There'll be more Democrats leaving.
There is one Democrat in Maryland who has announced that he will run for re-election, but he waited until his potential opponent said he wouldn't run. Tell us that story.
His potential opponent is the proverbial 400-pound gorilla, two-term Republican Governor Larry Hogan, who won re-election with ease in a state that is overwhelmingly Democratic, is a never-Trumper, a centrist Republican, and someone who does very well with minorities across the board. Polls show Larry Hogan beating Senator Van Hollen with relative ease. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell begged the governor to make this race. He wants to have friends in the Senate, and it helps if they're not friends of Donald. But in the end, Governor Hogan wants to go back to the private sector and has no interest in the Senate, in being one of 100 after he was number one in his state. As soon as he made that decision not to run for the Senate, guess who announced? Chris Van Hollen said he's seeking a second term. Wonder why he waited.
As usual, they came right down to the wire when it comes to funding the government. And it was one of those deadline votes, and some Republicans crossed the street on this one. Tell us about it.
Well, in order to vote for the full package to keep the government running, that takes a vote of the Senate. 19 Republicans went along with a package that included President Biden's vaccine mandates, something that is the bete noir of the conservative grassroots of the Republican Party. What's interesting among this gang of 19 is that includes the usual suspects, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, as well as centrists Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Rob Portman of Ohio, but it also includes some decisively good-as-Goldwater conservatives, Marco Rubio of Florida, for example, who faces a difficult re-election, and Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, a popular fixture on conservative cable news. One more interesting point on this. While the 19 demonstrated that they were not in touch with the grassroots of their party, four other Republicans said they were not even going to show up. Those were Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, Mitt Romney of Utah, Richard Burr of North Carolina, and Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma usually rated the most conservative of senators. Clearly, voting yes to continue to fund the government with vaccine mandates without a debate is something that's troubling to the grassroots. But not even showing up to vote, that's unconscionable to many.
With your dedication to your career, you get to really know a lot of the people that run Washington, and you get pretty close to the families, and you know the fathers and the sons. And there was a tragic passing this week of a sitting congressman, and it's someone you knew quite well.
I certainly did. Jim Hagedorn of Minnesota was someone that I'd known since he first dreamed of being a congressman and told his friends. That's when he was in high school, and during a game of touch football, he announced that he wanted to be a congressman just like his dad, then Congressman Tom Hagedorn of Minnesota. Well, it eventually took four tries on Jim's part, but he finally made it, winning a race by less than 2,000 votes out of more than 490,000 cast, one of the closest races of 2018. He was reelected by a slightly bigger margin, and according to the American Conservative Union, they gave him an 81% rating, making him the most conservative congressman from the Gopher State. But that was just fine with Jim Hagedorn, who checked all the boxes on abortion, the right to keep and bear arms, tax cuts, and opposition to such measures as the infrastructure bill or the Build Back Better bill. He was his own person and very much in the mold of his hero, whom his father took him to meet one day, President Ronald Reagan. In the end, he faced an opponent that he fought for 3 years but couldn't defeat, kidney cancer. He kept writing out that he planned to run for re-election, and he texted friends that while he was not feeling well, he'd be well enough to campaign. Last Saturday, I received a text from Jim Hagedorn from the intensive care unit at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, and he said he was pretty wrinkled. He died in his sleep 2 days ago at age 59. One thing about Jim Hagedorn that could be said were the same words that the then Vice President Thomas Riley Marshall said about Theodore Roosevelt when he died in 1919. He died in his sleep, and that's when death caught him, because had he been awake, there would have been a fight. Jim Hagedorn, a fighter and an achiever, someone I'll never forget.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. John, thank you.
Always a pleasure, even under some of the circumstances.
It's 7:22. It's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Cheryl Eckerson next. Right now, Albie Dees in the WMAL Traffic Center.
I have your latest traffic update, starting with the Beltway. In Maryland, no delays in Prince George's County or in Montgomery County. In Virginia, on the inner loop of the Beltway in McLean, there is a crash. Left lane is blocked near the George Washington Parkway, exit 43. In Fairfax County on 66, no delays being reported eastbound and westbound. 95 in Virginia, it's clear between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, northbound and southbound. In traveling between the two Beltways, either on the BW Parkway or 95 in Maryland, you're going to find all lanes clear, north and south. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy start to the weekend. We will see some gusty winds as a cold front shifts through midday. Highs today into the upper 40s. The cold front will shift through anywhere between 11 o'clock this morning west of town, 1 to 2 o'clock to the south and east. Behind that front, we'll have some very gusty winds through the afternoon. A wind advisory is in effect through 7 o'clock. Could see gusts upwards of 50 miles per hour. Now, winds will diminish tonight. Clear skies. It will be cold. Lows in the teens to 20s across region. For your Sunday, mostly sunny highs in the low to mid 40s. We'll warm up on President's Day Monday. High temperatures near 60 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
26 degrees, 7:22 on the Saturday morning update. It's the Saturday morning update for President's Day weekend. I'm Rick Fowler, and it's good to have you along for the holiday. Cheryl Atkinson joins us. She hosts Full Measure. That's tomorrow, ABC 7, 10 o'clock. And Cheryl, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me. Happy weekend.
Thank you. You've got a story, and it kind of reminds me of similar situations where there are programs that are designed and developed to help minority communities, and then ultimately it doesn't work out. You've got an example in Rochester, and it's a story that goes, what, 5 decades?
Yeah, and then some. I mean, when there was a lot of racial strife in the 60s, in Rochester, New York, apparently they had some rioting. And as a result, they have a large minority population there. And as a result of a lot of these sort of economic dissatisfaction, similar to what we hear today, there were clashes with police, bad neighborhoods, questions about treatment. But a lot of the big companies based in Rochester, like Kodak, started these really forward-thinking jobs initiatives to open up opportunities and hope to some in the black community. And they really did a lot of cool things. I mean, this is what we talk about in the cover story Sunday on Full Measure. But none of this had the long-lasting results that people hoped for. The question is why? And, you know, if you look nationally, the trillions and trillions of dollars that have been dumped into programs trying to help change the situation, because as you probably know, by race, black Americans fare the worst of any race in America when it comes to they are most welfare dependent. They are most poverty struck. Why is this with all the effort and money that's been put into it? And we found some really interesting answers in Rochester that might be lessons learned really for a lot of the country.
Well, it seems that there are millions and millions of dollars pumped in from federal funding and state funding and local funding. What did you find happened in Rochester?
Well, it's interesting because one after another, the people I interviewed who have this long-term view, they boil it down to a few things. You know, the education's horrible there, apparently, the public education, some of the worst schools in the country, but they spend some of the most per student anywhere in the country. They said upwards of $30,000 apiece. They've done all these renovations and a $1 billion upgrade that was started 7 years ago. So the education system's a mess, but it doesn't have to do with the money they're spending. And they told me the same thing with programs that come in from the federal government where they may say, we're going to help a person get a $50,000 loan to try to start a business. Well, they said, if that person doesn't have the skill set in the first place, they're not going to be able to make that $50,000 loan turn into something. So I guess I would say the bottom line I learned, even when Kodak and these companies open doors to jobs, if you're offering jobs to people in a culture where so many of them dropped out of school in 10th grade and where something like only 30% of them were even graduating from high school, that's not going to help them achieve, you know, doing the job offerings on paper. So that's part of what we found out.
One thing I enjoy about Full Measure, Cheryl, is you always have interesting people that sort of tell it straight, and you get to the heart of the matter, like, you know, when you talk with Ken Buck, the outspoken congressman on Capitol Hill, and you have an interview tomorrow on Afghanistan, and the person you're interviewing is at a pretty high level, and I think this is going to be fascinating.
Well, it's the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction who's watched the waste, fraud, and abuse of our billions and billions of tax dollars as we've spent money in Afghanistan over the years. So I connected with him. I've been trying to get an interview with him for quite some time about the Afghanistan withdrawal and what went wrong. And I found out, you'll hear on Sunday, Congress hasn't asked him to examine that botched U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. He takes his marching orders from Congress. But he is looking at some ancillary issues that have to do with all the tax money we're still planning to send to Afghanistan and how we're going to know how that's spent when now the country is run by the very people we spent all that money fighting for the last 2 decades, the Islamic extremists that we call terrorists, the Taliban. There's ISIS now making a resurgence. So that's part of his job. And you will also hear him talk about really some fiery criticism of the Pentagon, which kept secret a report that he issued before the withdrawal last year that was a warning, you know, it turned out to be very prescient with some things that might be happening if they didn't plan for it. And he says the Pentagon improperly kept his report classified for a year, meaning we couldn't know about it. And that's sort of been a story that he's told for quite a while, over classification of embarrassing information.
You know, the music industry has been hit so hard due to COVID, and it's even still impacted. I know there were some concerts in January here in the Washington area that were canceled in early February. The question, I guess, is, you know, in a place like Nashville, have they recovered yet, or are they still hit hard in Music City?
Well, they are recovering. I mean, there are some businesses, like everywhere, that will never reopen and never be the same, and some artists who left Nashville that will never come back. Maybe these are people who would have been stars. We did that story, I guess, about a year ago. And when we were back in the Nashville area shooting some stories, I thought, let's check back in and see what's going on. And we visited the Nashville Country Music Hall of Fame and found out, yep, things are coming back. They actually set some records for tourism once they opened that museum back up after losing a ton of money during the closures. So we did sort of a fun piece that has some history in it, too. Some fun music history as we got back to Music City to see how they're coming back.
That's all tomorrow morning, ABC 7, 10 o'clock. It's Full Measure with Cheryl Atkinson. And as always, thank you very much. Enjoy the holiday.
You too.
It's 729. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.
News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. The situation in Ukraine is dire. That's what Vice President Kamala Harris told diplomats at the Munich Security Conference today, a day after President Biden said he's convinced Russian President Vladimir Putin is ready to invade Ukraine.
Today, as we are all well aware, the foundation of European security is under direct threat in Ukraine.
Today, Russia carried out massive nuclear drills. Three men involved in a shooting at a 4th of July barbecue in 2020 that killed an 11-year-old boy plead guilty to voluntary manslaughter. Daryl Bond, Marcel Gordon, and Christian Wingfield agreed to spend anywhere from 7.5 to 10 years in prison for killing Davon Martin. The little boy was hit by a stray bullet as he walked toward an apartment in Southeast. The three will be sentenced in June. D.C. police planning for the arrival in the next few weeks of truckers protesting what they call unconstitutional COVID mandates. The People's Convoy will start its trip to the district from the West Coast next Tuesday. Chief Robert Conte.
We have to be realistic about, you know, what we could potentially see. There will be disruptions to traffic, that kind of thing. And I think we need to be very candid with the public about what some of the expectations, based upon what we've seen in Ottawa, what some of those things could be that we might see here in the district.
Canadian police arrested more than 100 protesters in Ottawa yesterday who've been blocking streets for more than 3 weeks as they protest their country's COVID restrictions. Traffic and weather next on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Traffic and weather on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
I have your latest traffic update starting with the Beltway. In Maryland, no delays in Prince George's County or in Montgomery County. In Virginia, on the inner loop of the Beltway in McLean, there is a crash. Left lane is blocked near the George Washington Parkway, exit 43. In Fairfax County on 66, no delays being reported eastbound and westbound. 95 in Virginia, it's clear between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, northbound and southbound. In traveling between the two Beltways, either on the BW Parkway or 95 in Maryland, you're going to find all lanes clear, north and south. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
A cold front moves through today. A wind advisory is in effect from noon to 7. Gusts as high as 49 miles an hour. A high of 51 degrees. Right now, 29 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
It is 7:35. It's the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, and Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer joins us. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Research and the author of Operation Dark Heart. Good morning, Tony.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Always great to join you.
Last weekend, there was a story that really blew up and a firestorm throughout the week, and it involved a filing in the John Durham probe. And
right.
It also involved the Clinton campaign. And we're going to talk with KT about this in terms of sort of the political side and how it, you know, how it affects democracy and these kinds of things, if in fact what they're alleging may have happened. But I wanted to talk with you kind of about the technical side sort of what it is they were doing. Translate into layman's terms what the allegation is that was going on. I think that might help us to put it in perspective. And I do want to get your opinion, too, on the political front. But what exactly are they talking about here?
So there was two prongs, if you will, of the Russia collusion narrative. One was inside of government. One was outside of government. There were points where they commingled. And what I think is the biggest takeaway from this Durham reveal is that the outside, the private sector version of what was going on, the camp funded and run by the campaign, the Clinton campaign, was more extensive, I think, than a lot of people fully understood. And in this case, they're talking about evidence that not only did they have essentially funding and used funding to establish the Russia, the dossier, the dirty dossier, whatever you want to call it, they were what we would call active measures going on as well. That is to say that they were engaged in actual hacking and trying to establish a narrative using essentially a university, which has not been identified yet, of young computer scientists who were supposed to go in and quote unquote find things within the Trump campaign and Trump organization servers and emails. Essentially, I would argue once you're in it to penetrate it, you can plant things. And I think almost from what I've seen, they were trying to posture themselves to start planting information, like this whole fictional link between a server and Trump Tower and some bank in Russia. Things like that were being created. They never existed. So that's what's the biggest significant piece of this, is that they were engaged in actual what we call professional information operations. They were trying to penetrate for purposes of not only understanding, but purposes of manipulation. Very sinister, very illegal. And that's why I think people who understand this were really fired up this past week by this reveal from the Durham investigation.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. You have political dirty tricks, and you have opposition research, and you do everything you can, obviously, in a political campaign. But at what point do you cross the line, and how far past the line may they have gone if the allegations are true?
Well, this is literally, I mean, this has been a term that's been overused, but this is literally an order of magnitude worse than Watergate, because Watergate was a bunch of you know, semi-competent thugs breaking into a campaign headquarters in the Watergate. This is wholesale manipulation at a nation state level, where you're trying to use professional individuals and university students who are, you know, very well versed and hackers essentially to get in and manipulate data. It would be illegal for you or I to do that to some private citizen. It's most certainly illegal for a campaign to do it to a presidential candidate, and then after that, against a sitting president. I would argue that's sedition. So clearly, everything you've ever heard of regarding Watergate pales in comparison to this. And that's why I think the media has been so focused on avoiding any discussion on this in the mainstream media.
Well, remember, Tony, Hillary Clinton says it's nonsense.
Well, you know, I mean, she'll have plenty of time to reflect that, I think, when they finally get up to – I do believe they're going to put her under oath on this. No, we always joke about this because I think we need to maintain a sense of humor. But I do believe at some point she's going to be put under oath and ask hard questions about what she knew and when she knew it, to coin a phrase.
All right, let's turn to Ukraine.
Yeah.
President Biden says an attack is imminent, but we've seen – activity, and how would you define where we are in terms of has an attack started, or where are we?
Yeah, there's two pieces I think we need to just define very quickly for the audience. First, Biden is saying what he's saying for purposes of trying to establish a narrative which he wins no matter what happens. That's why he keeps saying all this nonsense. You know, according to them, they were going to invade Wednesday. Rick, there was no indications of any of us who watched that they were going to invade Wednesday. It was essentially, from what I can ascertain from the intel, the Russians issued a warning order on that date saying, be prepared. This is the date we have to be prepared to go from. It was not the attack order. with that said, Biden keeps saying things like they're going to attack because he wants to win because he wants to be able to say, oh, I back them off. Or if they attack, he wants to be able to say they attack. So it's nonsense. They created the conditions for which we're facing, going back to the original allowing Nord Stream 2 to go forward and all the other weakness they continue to show. So that's one piece of it. Secondly, will there be an attack? Where are we at on that? I do believe Putin is planning some level of military action. I do not believe it's going to be a full-blown invasion that takes weeks or months for it to complete. I think it's going to be a continuation of the successful Putin nibbling away at the edges strategy, mostly bloodless, which I think has worked very well for him. And Rick, I would argue that this has worked for him till now. It's going to continue to work for him if he's patient. And I think ultimately you're going to see some level of conflict after the Olympics. What you see right now is essentially is harassment preparation. I know these are the things you would see as a conflict builds up. So those are the two pieces that I see that are in play right now.
Does he attempt to take the whole country, or does he just take a portion thereof?
No, like I said, I think, you know, they had the military action in Georgia a few years ago. They had they've taken over, you know, the Crimea and others. They continue to encroach in Donbass. I think you're going to see the consolidation of the Donbass region. They may try to do an economic, a full land link all around Ukraine into Crimea. And I think they're going to put huge pressure on the Zelensky government to make it fail so they can put or help work to install a more friendly government there. But I just don't believe Putin has a stomach for a long, protracted, bloody, highly contentious conflict. I think this is all about him continuing to execute a very patient strategy, which will, I think, what he thinks will eventually get him back everything within, you know, the next few years.
We're hearing reports that Russia will be conducting a nuclear drill today.
Yeah.
Can you define that for us?
So Putin has said very clearly that don't mess with them, I've got nukes. He said, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that's what he's done. So much like we would do, and if we were actually had an actual competent president and administration in place, we would be doing. He's trying to show that they have both the technical expertise and political will to do something. This was big during the Cold War for each side to demonstrate capacity as well as credibility. That's what he's doing. I think Putin wants people to believe, leave it to the eye of the beholder, that if push comes to shove, if he believes that there are a circumstance which he believes would justify it, he'd be willing to use nuclear weapons. And question is he mad enough to do that or not? Well, that's what he's trying to portray here, that he is mad enough to do something like that. And so it'll be very interesting to see how much media. And by the way, the fact that you're asking me about this indicates that Putin wants us to be talking about this. Again, Putin continues to dominate the political space with what he wants people to talk about. Again, Rick, we talked about this. We are playing Putin's game, and this is another example of it.
And last question, Tony.
Sure.
Putin says that he's moving troops back, and we say that he's assembling more troops. Do we have a sense of where the reality check is there?
Well, both can be true. I mean, during a run-up to conflict, you're going to have units of varying capabilities move around. One of the things we've not seen a lot of yet, which is the Russians are going to fight like they did during the Cold War. They're not going to change their tactics overnight or even over decades. Traditionally, if they're going to be in the attack, you have to have huge logistical trains forward. I mean, just big old depots of stuff because, you know, tanks and people use a lot of stuff. So what you're seeing right now is, I think, a little bit of swapping out units from the front to the back. Obviously, there's an exercise going on in Belarus. At this point, again, from what I've seen and the people I've spoken to, they don't have the big logistical stores forward that indicate that they're going to be able to do a sustained attack. With that said, they're switching units around and making it interesting. Look, they're masters of deception. This is but one more tactic within Putin's master plan for kind of making sure everybody's paying attention to him as he builds up to some sort of conflict.
And one thing, Tony, you've got the podcast at londoncenter.org. What's the topic this week?
So we've been doing a number of things. We've put out a number of things. We have one coming out on the Second Amendment. We just did taped yesterday. And there's one that's, I think, already out that covers a lot of China stuff. China Red Alert with Gordon Chang, one of our senior fellows that's off and on, and that's available too. So when we go through the kind of current issues that relate to Ukraine regarding China. So I think people will enjoy it.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, LondonCenter.org. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Rick.
7:47, Saturday morning update. We'll talk to KT McFarland next, but first, Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Virginia, on the Beltway, Inner Loop, in McLean, there is a crash. Left lane is blocked near the George Washington Parkway, exit 43. In Virginia, on 66, no problems on the eastbound side or on the westbound side. On 95 in Virginia, you're at speed between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, northbound and southbound. Maryland side of the Beltway, no delays in Prince George's County or in Montgomery County. And between the two Beltways on the BW Parkway in 95 in PG County, you're going to find all lanes clear, north and south. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy start to the weekend. We will see some gusty winds as a cold front shifts through midday. Highs today into the upper 40s. The cold front will shift through anywhere between 11 o'clock this morning west of town, 1 to 2 o'clock to the south and east. Behind that front, we'll have some very gusty winds through the afternoon. A wind advisory is in effect through 7 o'clock. Could see gusts upwards of 50 miles per hour. Now, winds will diminish tonight. Clear skies. It will be cold. Lows in the teens to 20s across the region. For your Sunday, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 40s. Warm up on President's Day Monday. High temperatures near 60 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
26 degrees. It's 7:48, the Saturday morning update. It's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by K.T. McFarland. She is the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. She is a board member of the American Conservative Union and President Trump's first Deputy National Security Advisor. KT, good morning.
Good morning.
We were talking a few minutes ago with Tony Schaefer about this story. It's been very much in the headlines on some of the media outlets this week. You wrote about it, an opinion piece at FoxNews.com. The Durham investigation has entered a new phase and two glaring questions stand out. That is your headline. And then the subhead, the media loved every minute of the 3 years of Russiagate. What are the two glaring questions, KT?
Well, the first one is, what was the role of the intelligence community throughout? Did they know about it? Did they know that Trump Tower during the campaign, and then later in the transition, where the transition, after Trump was elected, the transition, instead of being headquartered in Washington, D.C., was headquartered in Trump Tower, in the same offices that he had used for the campaign. So we now know from the Durham investigation made public that the Clinton campaign paid for an intermediary to hack into the internet searches and emails of the Trump campaign, the Trump presidential transition, and it extended on into the White House when the Trump administration went into the White House. So we know that the Clinton campaign was involved, but who else was involved? Was the intelligence community involved? Did they know about it in advance? And if they didn't know about it, why not? That's their job, is to protect maybe not candidates, but certainly presidents against wiretapping, intrusions, hacking. And they clearly didn't. If they had no idea, their excuse is they had no idea that this was happening. Well, I'd like to know why not. You know, this is not the Chinese. This is the Russians. This is Americans spying on Americans. Number two, did they know about it? And if so, what was their level of knowledge? Did they know about it and then just kind of wink and nod and turn the other way and pretend they didn't see it? Or probably the worst of all, were they actively involved? Were they facilitating the spying on a president of the United States? You know, there are only three answers here. They were either complicit, or they were corrupt, or they were totally incompetent. So I've hoped that when Republicans take the House and the Senate in less than a year's time, the first thing they investigate is the intelligence communities of what these guys are really up to. Have they been weaponized by the Democrats to spy on and try to take down not just President Trump, but conservatives and Republicans in general? And then the second question lies at the heart of what's in the West Wing today. You know, the guy who was supposed to be Hillary Clinton's during the campaign, in 2020, the chief foreign policy advisor. Well, it turns out he was a chief disinformation officer, too. because he was going around to all the news outlets saying, Russia, Russia, Russia. And he was using the information that they were getting from their wiretaps, and there was no information there. The wiretaps found that there was nothing going on between Trump and the Russians. But they used it. They spun it. They thought, well, even if there's nothing there, we'll make it up anyway. And then we'll peddle it to the media. And then the media, completely complicit, they were in on the con. They were making money off this. You know, the media ratings were never higher when they talked about Trump, 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 Russia, Russia, Russia. And the journalists, they gave each other prizes. They got fancy, expensive, lucrative book contracts and speaking gigs. They weren't about to, they didn't care about the truth. They wanted to make sure they were getting rich off of this. And so at the end of the day, everybody was exploiting the American people, right? The media was exploiting the American people, the Democrats, the Clinton campaign, perhaps even the Justice Department. So those are the two glaring answers, things I want answered. Because when you look at the man who was probably most responsible for spreading the lie, Jesus, his reward, he's now the National Security Advisor. He's the guy up to his neck in dealing with Russians over Ukraine. It's the way of Washington, right? You commit a crime big enough, or you tell a lie big enough, as Hitler's propaganda chief said, Goebbels. He said, if the lie is big enough and you repeat it often enough, people will come to believe it. And that's what happened.
We've got about 2 minutes left, KT. There's one paragraph. It's down toward the bottom of your opinion piece, but it really stands out to me. And you say, they did manage to force innocent Trump officials into debt to hire lawyers to defend themselves. They even tried to get innocent people to plead guilty to crimes they did not commit or to accuse others, including President Trump, of crimes he did not commit. It. And I think that is a huge point that is overlooked. The impact on people, even like yourself, public servants, you've spent your life in public service, working in the Pentagon, working in the White House, dedicating your life to this country, and you end up with legal fees over a misinformation campaign by another political campaign.
Yeah, this is a dirty secret that when you get targeted by the Justice Department or the FBI, in this case, the Mueller investigation, they go after people. They know they're innocent. They just go after them in case something might come up, in case they can trick them into making a mistake and therefore charging with a crime. The Mueller investigation, from its report, found out pretty quickly that there was no Russia, Russia, Russia there. But they went on, and they got young, innocent staffers who, you know, make $30,000 a year. And they said, well, you have to come and see the FBI. Well, you know damn well, if you don't go without a lawyer, you're really in trouble. And so they have to go out and try to find a lawyer. Lawyers like that cost $50,000 a year. So they can't. And the Justice Department and the FBI, they know this. And so if they can't get, in this case, they couldn't get Trump or Trump's people on a crime, they could at least punish them for working for Trump and being Republicans. And so they forced them into economic insecurity, in fact, in, you know, decades-long debt to defend themselves for crimes they didn't commit. In my case, the FBI and the Mueller people, they knew I hadn't committed a crime. So they tried to trick me into saying, well, maybe I did commit a crime. You know, maybe I lied to you and I didn't mean to lie to you. So they want you to plead guilty to a crime you didn't commit. And in my case, they made it pretty clear, although they were way too smart to say it in these words, but they made it pretty clear they wanted me to implicate other people, particularly President Trump, in crimes I did not think he committed. I mean, that's the dirt. Whoever comes into the White House next, take a look at the Justice Department and the FBI. Maybe it was just a few dirty apples at the top of the heap who were taking the whole used-to-be-respected institutions and politicizing them for political advantage. But maybe it runs even deeper. So I think that's, you know, we used to have a military and intelligence communities that were above politics. We don't anymore. And it's important to root that evil out wherever it is. And one of the ways you can do that, Rick, is to show up at CPAC. The Political Conservative Action Conference, which starts on Thursday in Orlando, Florida. If you can come, although I think we may be sold out of tickets, but you can certainly watch online because you'll see the whole range of conservatives, not necessarily Republican, but the whole range of issues, foreign policy, national security, the woke culture, and how people all over the country can stand up to take this country back from the crazies who seem to occupy the positions of power today.
I know you will be speaking there. We will be looking forward to talking to you from CPAC next week. KT's opinion piece, the Durham investigation, is at foxnews.com. KT, thank you so much.
Pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
An honor for us as well. 8 o'clock news next, then it's Garden Sense here on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9. WMAL.